For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, your favorite troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell and Mr. Mark Tuttle. Gentlemen, Congress has had some time to settle in and get unsettled all in the process. And it seems more and more we're hearing about a drift, or at least a fraternization with socialism. Is that something that's actually palatable to the United States?
I would say it's more than just a drift towards. A lot of members of Congress have kind of said that's what they believe. They are socialists.
It's like over 30 of them,
They've called themselves socialists. So this is terminology that they're using. Now, the question would be, when they're describing themselves as socialists, what exactly do they mean by that? I mean, there's been a lot of varieties of socialism in the past. I'm not sure they're necessarily identifying themselves with Lenin, Stalin, Marx, those types of people. I'm thinking they're probably more looking towards Sweden and Norway and saying, oh yeah, we want to become like Sweden and Norway, and they're socialists, so that's what we mean by socialism. But that's what they brand themselves. That's what they call themselves.
Yeah, it's very troubling, I would say, from a Catholic perspective too, because the Church has come out on many occasions with documents and pronouncements condemning socialism. And so a lurch in that direction is going to prove to be, I think, highly problematic for Catholics and living out our Catholic identities here in the United States, should we adopt more and more socialist programs and looking at the world through a socialist lens.
And when the Church condemns socialism, they're looking at it very theoretically, and they're condemning the idea of a denial of property rights primarily. I mean, their concern is this idea of ownership, this idea of stewardship that goes along with being a human being, and also the dignity of work too. I think those three components are what the Church looks at. But the evils of socialism historically, when you look at sort of the facts on the ground and what socialism looks like when it's implemented, there's a lot more evil than just that.
Yes. Well, I think you're right about some of those prominent features of socialism and why they're incompatible with the Catholic faith. The other one I'll mention, though, because it's called out in Centesimus Annus too, is atheism. It's inherently atheistic. This is drawing again back from Marx's view of things, and so this collapse of the religious sphere leads towards totalitarianism, is what the Holy Father in that encyclical points to, is that without a sphere of religiosity, especially authentic faith, to serve as a sort of check and balance to the power of the state, or to inform the state of principles around, as you mentioned, what it means to be authentically human, what does freedom mean, why are property rights important, what contributes to authentic human flourishing. These are all things that Holy Mother Church adds to the societies in which she's present. Socialism has proven to crowd that out and actually work towards extinguishing the light of faith where it's found.
Yeah, and it hasn't just crowded it out and kind of resulted in atheism. Socialism stands, it starts from a standpoint of atheism,
right,
to a certain extent. Marx's theory, mm-hmm, was that, the driving force of history is the struggle between classes. And that determines history. That is sort of the engine that moves human action, moves human progress, etc. And so right there from the get-go, what we Christians look at as providence and where we see the role of God and where we see the interaction of man with the divine. Marx says, no, that's all just mythological. That's all just apparent. What's really going on there is this struggle between the classes, and that's really what's playing the part of God. And that is the starting point from where Marx then builds the rest of his theories of socialism.
Right. He's fixated on and gives primacy of place, as I read him, to labor, to that labor, one's labor is the context by which and from which one finds human fulfillment. So in a move like that, part of what's happening, an important feature of that principle then becomes the totality of man is summed up in economic terms. And so that becomes the source of this struggle between the classes and this notion of who owns what labor. Do I own my own labor? Marx sees capitalism. One of the problems with capitalism, as Marx sees it, is that capitalism separates one from one's labor or the total of one's labor. Why? Because the worker is relegated to wages. And so the one way in which Marx proposes, as does socialism and communism proposes, to reunite the worker with the full value of their labor is through what? Common ownership.
Right. Collective.
Collective ownership, right, yep. Which we would call the public, right? The public owns these things. And who represents the public? Well, that would be the government.
Right. You have to have somebody that speaks on behalf of the public.
Correct.
And, well, why wouldn't that be me, Tim?
Right, exactly. But these struggles have been going on for a long time. And one of the prominent writers and critique of socialism and its devastating effect was the 20th century figure Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
Right. And why Solzhenitsyn was such a, I think, dramatic illustration of the evils of communism was first off, he felt the persecution that such a system often leads
firsthand.
To. But more importantly, he developed... And he didn't develop this alone. There were others at the same time kind of developing the same sort of outlook, but a standpoint of personalism. The Solzhenitsyn really developed this idea of history being moved by the individual, and that really when you break things down, it's the individual that is paramount, not necessarily any sort of collective or the government, etc.
Yeah. Well, we're going to, I suggest we bring in someone to help us unpack all that with Solzhenitsyn, someone who's very familiar with it. What do you think of that idea?
I think bringing on a guest is always a good idea.
Okay. Well, I think what we'll do then is we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to bring on a good friend of the show, been on Catholic Cave, in the Catholic Cave many times here on Catholic Radio Indy, Dr. David Deevil. He's the assistant professor of Catholic Studies at the University of St. Thomas up there in beautiful Minnesota. He's also the editor of Logos magazine, which I actually subscribe to. It's a fantastic Catholic journal, comments on culture and theology and those things. And he recently gave a talk or lecture up at the University of Notre Dame here in Indiana on Solzhenitsyn, which kind of gave us the idea to have him back on the show. And let's talk about this really very important figure from the 20th century. So stay tuned. You're listening to The Catholic Cave. We'll be right back.
Take Catholic Radio Indy's 40 Days of Lent Challenge. During Lent, listen to at least 1 hour of Catholic radio each day. If you're already a daily listener, add an hour each day or pick a different time to listen. Or if you really want to go all in, listen exclusively to Catholic Radio Indy from now until Easter. Spend 40 days with Catholic Radio Indy and see what a difference 100% Catholic programming 24/7 makes.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. This is Tim O'Donnell with Mark Tuttle, Kent Blanford, and as promised, joining us is Dr. David Deevil. Again, he's the assistant professor of Catholic Studies there at beautiful St. Thomas up in I think sounds like still frozen Minnesota. Sounds like you saw some snow up there and some ice.
Yeah, we're it's starting to melt, but of course every night it gets cold enough that we wake up in the morning and then slip again. So,
and I do like the winter. I like the snow, but I am not a fan of driving on ice at all.
Yeah. And so. I remember up in Minnesota and Wisconsin and those types of things, they would have fundraisers this time of year where they'd take a big pickup truck, an old beat up pickup truck, and drive it out into the middle of a lake. And then just wait, and people would wager on what day it would fall into the lake.
Oh, because yeah. Now that's good old Midwestern fun. Well, we are delighted to have you because, the impetus for having you on, Dr. Deevil, is I caught your lecture, recent lecture up there at the University of Notre Dame. On Alexander Solzhenitsyn, he's a prominent figure and someone we've wanted to talk about for quite some time here in the cave, and delighted to have you on because you're very familiar with his work. So if you could, for our audience, tell us a little bit about Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Who is he? Solzhenitsyn sounds like a funny name.
Yeah, well, Solzhenitsyn was a Russian of partly Ukrainian descent. We just celebrated his 100th anniversary of his birth last year. He was born in 1918, and he was raised by his mother. His father died quite early, and he was a young man who fell in love with with the romance of socialism and of the Soviet Socialist Republic. He then served in the military during World War II. He was a captain in the army. He saw a lot of things that kind of made him question, his devotion to the revolution. He saw war crimes against German civilians that were done by Soviet military personnel. And he served nobly. He was awarded. But he began to have some doubts. And in 1945... he wrote some derogatory comments about the war and about some of the things that he'd seen, and particularly about Uncle Joe Stalin,
who
was the leader of the
USSR. That can't go well for him.
No, it didn't. These letters were passed on. They were private letters, and he was accused of basically passing on anti-Soviet propaganda under the criminal code, and he was taken to a prison in Moscow. He was then sentenced to an 8-year term in a labor camp, which was a very common crime just for saying, being critical of the state. He ended up serving in several different work camps, and he took that time as a time of questioning his beliefs. And he began to see that what was wrong with his life and with the Soviet Socialist Republic was that he had replaced God with the government and with the state. And he talked about it later in a number of poems, as well as many of his other prose writings, as a time in which he discovered the cornerstone of the universe, which was justice. He realized that if he was going to say things were wrong, there had to be justice. And if there was justice, there had to be a God. And slowly he turned himself back to Christianity. He returned to the Eastern Orthodox Church, which he had been baptized and confirmed and communed in. And he spent a number of years then writing about this. He had cancer, which he wrote about in his book, The Cancer Ward. He wrote novels like The First Circle about the camps. He wrote One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, about one day in one of those camps, which was his sort of breakout bestseller in 1962. He was allowed to publish it because this was the thaw after Stalin had died. And then he became a very popular figure, but eventually he became too popular and too outspoken about the problems of the USSR. And he was eventually exiled in the 1970s. He spent about 25 years in the United States, living in Vermont. He won the Nobel Prize, the Templeton Prize for religion. And then after the fall of the communist regime in the USSR, he returned to Russia in the 1990s and spent the rest of his life there until he died at the age of 89 in 2007. What we have now is so many works of his, the great three-volume Gulag Archipelago, which was a kind of a literary experiment, had a lot of history, but with some sort of novel forms, a little bit of fiction as well. We have the series that he's done on the revolution. Many of these works are still being published in English for us now. But I think he's more important for us today than he was even then, especially now that many people are sort of turning away from religion, away from freedom, away from these sort of ideals, and looking to socialism. And I think he's a great figure to say, hey, hold on, remember what you have.
Yeah, and he didn't just do that as a figure. Looking back, he actually physically did that. He's got some lectures and things that are pretty direct warnings to the West that we were headed in a lot of the same directions that the Soviet Union went.
That's right. In the 1970s, when he had come to the U.S., he gave a series of lectures all over the country, and he would say things like, "Look, you guys have it great here. Your founders, you know, had great ideas about a proper and humane sort of republic. You have, in many ways, there's a reality that when he would travel to small towns, he realized that there was a lot of good, that there were people who were both religious and moral and honest. But when people would say, well, should the Soviet Union be modeled on the United States? He would say, no, I don't think so, not in your present state. And he saw many of the problems that he had seen in his home country beginning to develop in the U.S. in the form of political correctness in universities, a media that sort of reported only the news that was fit for the party that they preferred, things like that. And so he really warned against a sort of an easy, well, let's just all be Americans. But at the same time, he emphasized that what we have as Americans is very important, and we need to renew those resources.
Yeah, I remember one of his big warnings that struck me was a warning against the materialism that was seeming to become more and more rampant in the United States. And, he saw that identity with, I think, kind of a worldliness rather than people finding their identity in God to be something that was troublesome, and also just sort of rang some bells for him that, you know, look, this is what communism was founded on, is this sort of denial of God and kind of the atheism of communism. And in a lot of ways, the consumerism that's going on in the West is just sort of the flip coin of the same thing.
That's right. I mean, you know, that sort of emphasis on happiness as simply well-being and having enough consumer goods is really a dangerous one. I mean, you know, you point out that it's, you know, that's really at the basis of the materialist vision of Soviet communism as well. He liked to talk about one of the gulags, the Solovki gulag, had a sign about basically this way to happiness. And it was the same sort of notion that, well, once your biological and your material needs are taken care of, you're happy. But that's not really what human beings are like. And what we have, he talked about a tragic loss of political will that we've had because we're too afraid to lose our material goods in order to defend ourselves. And so we're really in a precarious sort of situation, even though, materially speaking and economically speaking, things in some senses have never been better.
Would you explain maybe a little bit about, for our listeners, you brought up the word gulag. What was the gulag system that he, because yeah. I think that really becomes pivotal in his conversion.
Yeah, the gulag system was, he called it, his great work was the Gulag Archipelago, like a chain of islands of these Soviet prison camps. And many of them were ostensibly for prisoners who were taken for crimes, but most of the time they were for thought crimes, for the kinds of things that ended him up in one of them, which was to have criticized the regime in any way or even to have been accused of it. And this system of prisons basically was a brutal and horrifying thing. The only real comparison we have on that scale is the Chinese Lao Gai system, which was a similar sort of prison camp system that kept people who were critical of the regime or unhappy with those in power. It was a horrible, horrible thing, and much of Solzhenitsyn's writing was designed to bring out the memory and the truth that he discovered there, and the reality of the misdeeds and the crimes that were committed there. And yet, at the same time, you know, Solzhenitsyn, as a sort of a Christian humanist, realizes that it was there that he had the opportunity to really think about his life. When the material goods were stripped away and when the freedom was stripped away, he had to ask himself the questions about what freedom was. So he has a kind of odd, as I think all Christians should, a kind of odd view about the sufferings that he endured. They were the opportunity for him to discover what was really real, and yet they are as well something that we should work to not ever have.
Yeah, that contradiction between having his physical freedoms restrained and therefore him kind of finding the spiritual freedom to be able to not only find God, but honestly find companionship and human love among other people there in the Gulag system. I think that's really the sort of central charm and really central lesson of the Gulag Archipelago.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. He found friends, and I think that's what drove him to tell about these memories in story form and historical form, that these had become his friends, and he had realized the value of a human being. Whereas on the flip side, what Soviet socialism, what Soviet communism did, was it got rid of that sense of the dignity of the human person. There was no moral law that restrained anybody, and people were simply cogs in a machine, and if they got in the way of the state, they were to be eliminated. They had no rights. What Solzhenitsyn discovered when he discovered justice and the moral law was he also discovered the dignity of man made in the image of God.
You know, and part of the irony, too, around Solzhenitsyn is his life, I think, is an example of how this impulse to try to get rid of the dissidents, push aside those that disagree with the regime, magnified their message. So it was only from him being in the Gulag that he was really able to kind of have his conversion and write that. And then it was only from his exile and being sent away from the Soviet Union completely into the West that gave him kind of a global voice to be a critic of the system.
That's correct. I mean, he was awarded the Nobel Prize, and essentially he didn't go to receive it, because he would have not been able to come back. But he was eventually exiled anyway, and I think that the leaders of the regime at the time thought they had gotten rid of him. But what they did was they allowed him to now spread his message everywhere. And it's a curious thing because when he went to the West, what he discovered was that we had many of the same problems, and it was based on that same sense of materialism and a kind of practical atheism that we were talking about earlier. And so when he came to the West, he was immediately, lionized. But then when he started to say, you know, things here aren't so great either, that many people began to get very upset because he wasn't just talking about, you know, something that was particular to Russia or, you know, sort of an East Asian mentality. He was talking about something that was pernicious in the West as well.
You know, I think one of the points that we kind of stumble over and is a stumbling block for us, particularly now, at this point of history, is his nationalism. He was very much a Russian patriot and very nationalist and had sort of a nationalistic underpinning to a lot of his beliefs. And that doesn't necessarily sit well in the day and age of the EU, the expanding idea of this global community we're trying to create. He was very much a contradiction to that.
Yes, he was not. Well, I mean, he saw what the UN was worth in terms of how it dealt with the countries under Soviet domination. It was not an organization that served people, nor were these international groups quite often doing that. They didn't care about people who lived in actual places. And I think he's often accused of having a sort of an extreme nationalism, but we talked earlier about his times living in the United States. He had great things to say about the people that lived here. He had great things to say about our traditions. He appreciated the local, and so his was not a kind of jingoistic, Russia is the best and everybody else is garbage. No, it was an appreciation of the particular communities that we've been set up in. I think about, the book of Revelation, all of the nations will stream into the city of God. Well, in order for that to happen, there have to be nations. You have to love, the place that you're from.
Right. What is it, do you think, Dr. Deevil, what is it about his critique of socialism that you think might be most relevant to us today about some of the things he was calling out?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the first part is that, as he said a number of times, especially in some of those addresses in the 70s, but particularly in the Harvard address, the most important thing is that men have forgotten God. Mm. And, the socialism was essentially built on an atheist foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take away God from that, when you take away any sense of the natural moral law, any sense of justice, you're going to be left with a recipe for tyranny. But one of the other things that I think that is very important for us today is that he understood that there were people who said, well, that's not the kind of socialism that I want. I want a sort of a softer socialism.
Right.
So one of his.
I can do it. I can make it work.
Right.
Give me
the
power.
Never really been tried in the way that I've tried it. But he always said, look, socialism is always pushing its way to communism, because once you go on that track of saying that, well, you have a state that sort of does everything, everybody's going to try to push further and further until you end up in the same place. So I think, that's something to remember in our day of saying, well, but we're going to try it and it's going to be completely different. Ours is going to be a democratic form or something like that. And he says, look, you can have that, but that's not what's going to win. What's going to win is going to be the real deal here, where the state really does own everything and has control over every aspect of one's life.
And I get a sense, too, from him of, and I'm not sure if he read Aristotle, studied Aristotle, but there seems to be what I would identify as an Aristotelian conception of man and government, that communities are natural entities, that they happen naturally, and they're cooperatives of people taking care of each other. They're built on friendships and sort of mutual interest, and something like communism is an artificial construct that naturally has to try to destroy that. And so anything that's going to threaten that sort of natural community is something that we should be wary of.
That's correct. What he really admired when he came to the United States, like I say, he had great words for the founders and for our system, such as it is, ideally speaking. But what he really admired and what he thought worked so well were the communities that he saw in rural New England. He lived in Vermont. And what he saw there was exactly that sense of a real community in which people take part in the goods that are around them. And there's a small enough community that you can have a sort of responsibility, you can have accountability, and you can have what's real. I mean, perhaps that's a problem for all large states, but that's what he saw, was that sort of natural political community, which, as you point out in Aristotle's view, was basically the size of a city. So maybe you didn't know everybody, but you kind of had a boundary around it. And that's what I think he saw we had to get back to. It's not that he was opposed to international trade or free trade or anything like that, but, his point was that if those sorts of things, are taken apart from real communities, they're going to be terrible. And so we have to have a context for technological progress, for free trade, for international action, things like that. There have to be real groups of people there. and they have to have accountability to the people that are within their reach.
And, you know, part of what I think he was pointing out with the Gulag Archipelago is that those communities are natural, and even if you've got a system like the Soviet Union that's trying to stamp them out, that's trying to get rid of them, they're going to erupt and evolve even in unlikely places like a prison camp.
Yeah, you know, you pointed this out earlier, that in his work in the Gulag Archipelago and One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, what's most affecting is the camaraderie and the friendship. There are clearly disordered aspects of this in a prison camp, but at the same time, there is a community and a friendship, and there's something there that people can become a part of. And one of the greatest moments in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich is that in the afternoon when they're everybody's kind of taking a break for a second because something's broken, and they're trying to start this fire out. It's 17 below in the workstation that they're at. It relates a lot to my Minnesota experience here. But,
I bet.
That's why you're so connected to Solzhenitsyn.
That's right. They didn't cancel work in the gulag unless it was 41 below. So very much like this. But they, you know, they're sitting around a fire that they've built in order to get the place warm enough to do some of the work, and one of the crew leaders starts telling stories, and there's this is the sense of a bunch of men who are together, listening to another man talk, warming their feet, trying to dry out what's left of their shoes, and that's that sort of natural community in which there's something human that's preserved, and he could see that there, and he knew that it does rise up, you know, as you said.
You brought up something at the very beginning of our conversation about his recognition of justice, that it was sort of in the absence of justice that he recognized that there must be justice. And that ultimately led to his conversion. That sort of recognition of an eternal truth like that, that is so lost in today's culture. And I think that's probably one of the, if I had to say anything about Solzhenitsyn to current readers of him, I would say pay attention to that.
Yeah. He thinks that these things are absolutely important. These foundational principles of life, these transcendental concepts, and that's what was gotten rid of by the Soviet regime intentionally, right? Because you can't have people thinking about this. Gary Saul Morson, who's a professor of Slavic studies at Northwestern, recently wrote a piece about this in Commentary magazine, and noting that this was intentional. If you read Lenin, if you read Stalin, they're insistent that you can't have any kind of concept of justice or natural law or freedom or anything like that is independent of the state, because if you do, then you have a ruler by which to measure things. And if you have a ruler by which to measure things, then you can say, well, the state is not doing right. And the sad thing is that in our time, you know, through a sort of, you know, relativistic sort of terminology that we use and a desire to be empathetic, we've kind of done the same thing, but without having it be done to us from on high. We've kind of gotten rid of these concepts because it makes us uncomfortable that then somebody might judge somebody.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, we've kind of done to ourselves what the communist overlords were trying to impose on everybody by violence.
Right, we self-selected
We just kind of voluntarily did it to ourselves.
Right. I mean, you know, people talk about this with regard to, you know, the internet and our freedom and our security and privacy, and it's sort of like, well, but we've given over to Facebook and Twitter and Instagram all of the information that, you know, we would have been outraged if the government had come to our door, and yet we say, oh well, you know, well, we've got to do this in order to be okay, be just folks.
Yeah, I've joked with my wife before that the only thing that Orwell got wrong in 1984 is he forgot the part that we were going to pay for Big Brother.
Right. Yeah. Well, and
I was going to say, let me just reintroduce you, Dr. Deevil, for our audience who are just maybe tuning in. So we're speaking with Dr. David Deevil. He's the Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies at the University of St. Thomas up in beautiful, but maybe perhaps still frozen, Minnesota. And we've been talking about Alexander Solzhenitsyn and his, as a historical figure and his relevance to us today, especially in light of these political impulses towards socialism. So, Dr. Deevil, what would you say if I were to ask you to summarize Solzhenitsyn's view of the human person? What might come to mind for you?
Well, I think it would be a person who is under God, right? Again, that mm-hmm. emphasis. Men have forgotten God. That's the problem. Man is under God, and he is made to live in these communities, and he is made for the highest things. And that, you know, that's another aspect of this, of what we're talking about. We do to ourselves what the Soviets did to their people. We have given up on the highest ideas and are content merely to think about things, only on the lowest level of material comfort and of sort of emotional comfort. Whereas we're meant, if we're to remember to be under God, we're meant to seek out those highest ideas of justice and to go further into life and to create communities that reflect that justice and indeed that love. He's not somebody who, you mentioned that sort of the critique of him as a kind of nationalist. Another one is that he's this sort of Luddite who would really have us go back to living in the way of, 19th century Russian peasants or something.
Right.
But he never says that. His point is that there's no way out but up. In other words, we can't sort of go back to the Middle Ages or the antiquity or something like that. What we need to do is not get rid of all technology or get rid of, the complexities of life, but we need to turn towards God and bring human life in all of its complexity today and all of its particularities under God's rule. And that, that's not a sort of theocracy or something like that. He certainly was critical of the churches, particularly the Russian Orthodox Church. He didn't want a sort of clerical dictatorship, but what he wanted was a society in which each person understood that he or she is under God and is responsible to God and for everybody around him, and to use those gifts in order to bring society higher, not backwards or back to the good old days.
You know, Solzhenitsyn's known a little bit as sort of a prophetic voice, an international character. I mean, he got the Nobel Peace Prize. He had a international platform with which to speak to the world. But this was not something that he sought out or took for himself. This was something that was kind of almost shoved. He was kind of put in just based on his own circumstances. So he, to me, to a great extent, his life is just sort of that epitome of the dissident witness that is put on the stage almost reluctantly.
Yes, one of the funny things, he didn't really want to leave. Excuse me, he didn't want to leave Russia. He was essentially kind of forced out. And when he got to the West, he was not out to be famous. He did give speeches in various places, and he did talk to people. But he wasn't a glory hog in that way, and he was sort of horrified when the press mobbed him when he was in the U.S. He actually lived a kind of secluded existence in the little town in Vermont that he stayed in for 20 years. And what he liked about them was the fact that they guarded his privacy. There wasn't a sort of we're selling maps to the Solzhenitsyn house or anything
right.
like that.
Yeah.
The people there actually protected him, and it was very difficult to get to him. He didn't want to live in the limelight. He wanted to work on this prophetic work of bearing witness in his literary projects and documenting the Gulag, documenting the problems in the revolution itself, documenting all that needed to be written about in order that someday people would be able to look back on this and say, look, we have to remember what things could be if we let things go down this path.
You almost get this picture that if he'd moved somewhere else, somebody would have like hit him up with the idea of, I know, why don't we make a gulag theme park?
And Lord.
We can let people experience, you know. And
yeah, kind of like an escape room almost.
I think
once you're in it, you want to get out.
Right, yeah. I think I'm glad he settled down in rural Vermont.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there, Dr. Deevil, are there any themes or points that you might be critical of Solzhenitsyn, things where maybe you thought he missed the mark a little bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, he was a great admirer of John Paul II. I think he recognized in John Paul somebody who was important. Many people say in the 20th century battles against Soviet totalitarianism, you know, the great figures are Solzhenitsyn, John Paul, then probably Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher.
Uh-huh.
So he was appreciative of that, but he does have a kind of he does have a view of Catholics that I think is sometimes a little bit rough, a little bit like Dostoevsky's views.
Mm,
you know,
yeah.
In Dostoevsky's works, you know, the Grand Inquisitor is depicted as this sort of ultimate evil. Solzhenitsyn wasn't quite that way, but he did think. He was very critical of Poland, right, the Catholic country of Poland.
Mm-hmm.
And he also took a view of the Middle Ages that it was too focused on the things of heaven, basically, you know, too heavenly-minded to be any earthly good, which I think is not a completely accurate view of the Middle Ages. What's remarkable about the Middle Ages is that you did have sort of a great deal of heavenly-mindedness, but what it created was a series of real places in Western Europe that, you know, that we ended up calling Christendom. So I think he's sometimes not anti-Catholic, but I think he doesn't quite give either medieval Catholics or even some modern Catholics a quite fair shake. But at the same time, as I say, he was very much willing to acknowledge the greatness of a figure like John Paul II. He was greatly impressed with the thought of G.K. Chesterton.
Oh, okay.
Joseph Pierce, the Catholic literary biographer, mm-hmm. he wrote a volume on Solzhenitsyn, and Joseph told me that essentially he was able to go and spend a lot of time with Solzhenitsyn because Solzhenitsyn knew about his biography of Chesterton.
Okay.
And when Joseph Pierce got to his house, he saw a whole line of Chesterton books.
So
Solzhenitsyn, you know, whatever his views on various aspects of Catholic thought, he appreciated some of the great Catholic thinkers of his time and before. So.
And that's only natural because Solzhenitsyn, above all else, he was a writer. I mean, that's what he set out to do. He was a writer. And you mentioned Dostoevsky earlier. You know, what's the relationship there between Solzhenitsyn as this dissident writer, communist times, you know, the rest of the Soviet Union had kind of moved into this sort of Soviet realism period of their literature. How is Solzhenitsyn related to some of the earlier Russian writers?
Yeah, I think that he really did. He worshipped them in a way. You know, there are lots of figures who will say, Richard Pipes, who is a late historian who did not like Solzhenitsyn a lot, used to say that, you know, as for American government, it was much superior to Russian government in any of its phases. But when it came to Russian culture, it was far superior to American culture. And Solzhenitsyn took part in that, and he often reflects on, you know, on great writers before him, Chekhov, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy. I think he probably related more personally to Dostoevsky, who was, you know, seriously an Orthodox Christian, than he did to Tolstoy, who was a kind of, liberal humanist of a sort, who always had sort of, you know, fond, perhaps a greater novelist than Dostoevsky, but somebody who didn't really understand reality, you know, on the level of the spiritual in the same way.
Yeah.
So I think he leaned more towards Dostoevsky.
Right, yeah. Tolstoy was always trying to capture that sort of international brotherhood of man and those types of things. And Dostoevsky, like Solzhenitsyn, was very critical of that idea and very critical of the idea of anybody being responsible for your own destiny and your own salvation other than yourself.
That's yep. right.
Wasn't it? Yeah. Was it in Brother Karamazov where, I might have this wrong, Dostoevsky has one of the characters saying, "Without God, all things are possible."
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think that's Ivan, the brother.
The brother, right?
Who's an atheist, and that's right. I mean, and Solzhenitsyn saw that. I mean, that notion that without God, without a rule, without justice out there, pretty much everything is permitted. And he knew that, and he saw that in his time in the camps. And again, that's where I think he connects more with Dostoevsky. I mean, you know, Dostoevsky's great. He has a great figure in the Brothers Karamazov. You know, a sort of Russian Orthodox monk. And Solzhenitsyn will have characters like that. Although, interestingly enough, in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, the character who's most like a Dostoevsky, mystic, is actually a Baptist, which shows, Solzhenitsyn's sort of sensitive, his ability to evoke surprise, mm-hmm. but also to his fairness. He saw that all those who believed in God and particularly believed in Christ, had this capacity to be heroic and saints. And I like that that's his figure that he uses in One Day in the Life. And again, in the other works, too, he will depict Catholics, particularly Ukrainian Catholics, as very heroic as well. He was, again, he may be a nationalist in a general sense, but he's not a jingoist. And he didn't think, only the Russians were the best. He recognized the people from all over the Eastern Bloc countries who were heroic, and he recognized them whether they were Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or whatever.
Another writer that Dostoevsky's identified with is Andrei Sakharov, because they were both very much persecuted at the same time. And, I think Sakharov's persecution was a lot more dramatic. How much did Solzhenitsyn see himself as a martyr, though? I mean, how much did that sense of martyrdom enter into his picture of things?
Well, I mean, curiously enough, I think he understood himself to be a martyr in the sense of being a witness, that sort of basic literal sense of what martyr is. But he did not like the idea of sort of claiming, because of his experience, that he had some sort of a profound way of judging everybody else or something like that. He has actually, in one of his poems, it's called Prisoner's Right, he talks about the fact that he says that nobody does owe us anything. If I could just give you a little bit of this. He says, "Yoke of years that we lived in a prison grants no rights. We're entitled to naught, not to pulpits, nor lecterns of glory, nor power, nor halos of saints, nor in memoirs, to mix with fatigue our colorless ashen complaints." And he goes on like that, saying that nobody owes us anything because we're prisoners. What's the one thing that we get out of this? Not glory, not the right to lecture everybody, but he says, "An illumined interior suffering core. May for everything this be our one recompense." I mean, I love that.
Wow, that's really
interior
profound.
That's what we get, but we don't get to judge everybody. So, I think he did think of himself as a martyr, but in that primal sense of witness, and not, he certainly didn't use it to judge others, and he was grateful and said, "That's what we need to carry off, and that's what we need to do when we have freedom, is to keep what we've taken from our suffering, and make that bear fruit in our lives." So,
if someone were to want to explore Solzhenitsyn a little bit based on our conversation today, Dr.
Yeah.
Deevil, do you have a book or two that you'd recommend?
Well, I think the best way to look into Solzhenitsyn is to take a look at the Solzhenitsyn Reader, which was published by ISI Books in 2007. It was edited by my friend Daniel Mahoney, who's one of the leading social needs and scholars today, and my late teacher, Edward Erickson Jr. And this social needs and reader has selections from the big works. So you'll get chapters from the Gulag Archipelago, from In the First Circle, from Cancer Ward. But then you'll get the great speeches, the Templeton Lecture, the Harvard Address. Mm-hmm. And then you'll get poems like Prisoner's Right, the one that I just read a little bit from. So I think it's the best. It's about 500 pages, but it's bits and pieces. It's all different kinds of things. I think it serves as the best introduction for people to take.
Well, that's fantastic. And you know what? We're about out of time. How can we? I can't thank you enough for the conversation that we've had about Solzhenitsyn. So, Dr. Deevil, how do people stay in contact with you and your work?
You can find me at Logos, a journal of Catholic thought and culture.
I'm a subscriber. I highly recommend it.
Yes, please subscribe. We've run pieces. We actually ran a piece last fall on one of Solzhenitsyn's great stories in his collection, Apricot Jam. But it's stthomas.edu, that's stthomas.edu/logos, L-O-G-O-S. So you can find the journal here, and you can find me on Facebook and LinkedIn and all over the place.
Hey, fantastic. Well, God bless. Thank you so much for coming back to the Catholic Cave. We'll have you back again real soon.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Whatever's going on, it gets me back on track.
It reminds me that no matter what happens during the day, God's got it.
Catholic Radio Indy.
The Spring 40 Days for Life campaign will take place March 6th through April 14th. This peaceful, prayerful vigil will be held from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and noon to 7 p.m. on Sunday outside the Planned Parenthood offices at 8590 Georgetown Road. Join pro-lifers from across central Indiana in praying to change hearts and save lives. For more information or to sign up to participate, go to 40daysindy.org. 40 days, peaceful, prayerful, and powerful.
When it's easy to give up, don't. When it's easy to give in, hold on. When you're thinking you're about to give out, ask for help. Catholic Radio Indy.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. We are still here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford, and we just got done with a fabulous discussion about Solzhenitsyn with Dr. Deevil. Russian literature, I think, opens up a view of Christianity because it's a little different and a little foreign to us, it strikes us and it makes us think a little bit more.
Yeah, the that Orthodox perspective that's imbued, especially Russian Orthodox, because it's 1,000 years old, and their lived experience of Orthodox Christianity in Russia, especially under the czars, just really informs who they are. And so the great figures which were mentioned, like a Dostoevsky, I like Chekhov too quite a bit, reading a lot of his plays, short stories. But they're really Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn are just indispensable. I love that book suggestion. I threw it in my Amazon shopping cart right now and tagged it for a Christmas wish list for you to get for me, Mark.
Uh-huh. Very good. Yep. And I've got it on my bookshelf. So if I don't get it for you as a gift, I'll loan it to you. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Regift. That's, yep. I'm totally fine with that when it comes to books.
And yep. You want the $80 hardcover, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Yep.
But there's so many lessons to be learned from Solzhenitsyn. He's so prophetic, as we were talking about, for our own times, and that real danger of atheism and practical atheism that is really growing in our own current setting.
And ironically, when you read a lot of Solzhenitsyn, what you learn most as you get to know him isn't from his writings. What you learn most about him comes from his life and the life he lived. And he lived the life of a devoted Christian gentleman. And, having that sort of witness, having that sort of, identity about you, of just simply being a Christian gentleman, simply doing what's right, simply doing what Christ calls you. That's an example that I think any of us can follow, no matter how much Solzhenitsyn we read or not.
And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for this week. For Timothy O'Donnell, for Mr. Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, have a wonderful Lent, and we'll see you then.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.